Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is an encore edition of Soundcheck.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Before there was Bob Marley and the Wailers, there was just the Wailers. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, the origins of an iconic Jamaican reggae group. And later, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones play live in our studio. But we begin with the Wailers, three boyhood friends, Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Livingston, who wound their way from the dangerous slums of Kingston, Jamaica, to the stages of the world. But the path they took was hardly paved in gold, and it took them in three very different directions. Historian Colin Grant traces their journey in a new book called The Natural Mystics, Marley, Tosh, and Wailer. He joins us from the studios of the BBC. Colin, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me.
So much has been written about Bob Marley, much less about Bunny Livingston, a.k.a. Bunny Wailer, and Peter Tosh. What drove you to take this look at the kind of formative years of these three?
My parents are Jamaican, and growing up in England with Jamaican parents in a Jamaican household, we always knew that there were these three lions, Bunny, Bob, and Peter. But the story was told again and again of Bob Marley. And I wondered what had happened to the other two, why, relatively, the other two were eclipsed. And it was my ambition to reunite them in a way, to establish the fact that they were first among equals. Each one of them could have been the one, and yet one was chosen and two were largely, in terms of biographies anyway, are forgotten.
So you've set yourself a difficult task because these are three kids who grew up, you know, poor. The theme of fatherlessness comes through, you know, repeating through the generations. There's not a big paper trail. How do you tell the origin story without it becoming a creation myth?
Well, I paint in the social background. In a way, the book is three books in one. It's the biography of the Wailers, but there's a social history of Jamaica, and then I pop up as a writer travelling in Jamaica. I've been going back and forth from England to Jamaica for the last 25 years. But in a sense, this book starts at the end of my last book. The last book was on Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey, a black nationalist leader, Jamaican hero, died in 1940. Mm-hmm. And in 1940 or thereabouts, all these boys were born. And these boys were born in bloodshed. They were born at the behest of their kith and kin, obviously, but they were born at a time when there was a great rebellion on the island. There'd been this rebellion against the British in 1938. And so they were born in that spirit of rebellion. There was a turmoil that happened in 1938 where there was a big sugar plantation that was brought into stream in on the outskirts of Westmoreland in the west of the country. And it led to a great conflagration because the workers were paid far less money than they expected. And many of the people that we now are familiar in terms of Jamaican politics came out of that period. Mm-hmm. The founders of Jamaican independence came out of that period, two men, Buster Manty and Norman Manley. And in a way, those boys were very, very aware of the privations and the violence that had surrounded them in their early lives.
So it's not just that this music appeared out of thin air. There was this larger social context that you were eager to kind of paint for us.
Yeah, because all three boys came from the countryside, and they were all country boys come to town, and the countryside was wedded to them. And they were very, very poor. In the countryside, it was a sort of place where they would have to cut up car tires to use as shoes. They called them power shoes. They would use umbrella leaves. They would use banana leaves as umbrellas, mm-hmm. and they would fashion cricket balls out of mango stones. And so they were familiar with the very hardship of life in the country. And when they came to Kingston, they found that life was even equally harder because they all met in Trenchtown, this place which locals called The Rock. And it was an empire of dirt. It was a very harsh place. It came to be thought of as a kind of Hollywood in that it had many, many stars, many, many poor stars, but people with great skills. But actually, it was a place where there was no great sewage system. So, for instance, there was this scandal known as the scandal bags. And the scandal bags were what people deposited their feces in the early hours of the morning, and then they would creep out and deposit them on the outskirts of town. And there was no great provision for water even. People like Bunny, Bob and Peter would have to share one standpipe. And often, Bob Marley especially was a vagabond youth. He travelled throughout Kingston with no real resting place. There's no place that he could call home. And in a way, these boys were what in Jamaican terms would be called force ripe. In other words, they were mature beyond their chronological years. They were forced to be more mature than they actually should have been.
And although they did come from outside the city, it was in Trenchtown where the three of them ultimately come together and form this group, the Wailers, which was the last of a number of different names that they were sort of bandying about, I guess, back in the, what would this be, early 60s.
Early 60s, yeah. It was interesting to me to think of the way that the band evolved in terms of their look, because in a way they started off as rhythm and blues singers. They wore two-tone suits and they had brill-creamed hair. And yet in the course of 10 years they went from that look to wearing battle fatigues and dreadlocks and becoming these exponents of Rastafari.
Which is one of the threads that goes through this book. Again, the book is called The Natural Mystics, Marley, Tosh, and Wailer. We're speaking with Colin Grant, author of the book, historian and contributor to the BBC. He's on the line with us from the BBC studios in London. These are the Wailers and a song about Trenchtown called Trenchtown Rock. Trenchtown Rock from the Wailers. That's Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Livingston, later Bunny Wailer. They are the subject of the book The Natural Mystics by Colin Grant. Colin, how odd was it for three boys, old and wise beyond their years, forced that way by privation and poverty, to actually make music in this setting, in Trenchtown?
Well, there are lots of people who do sing. There are lots of stars in the making in Trenchtown. And in a way, there was much competition. And one of the things I discovered in the course of writing this book is that they got their first break in a variety show in a theatre called Opportunity Hour. And it was a theatre where many, many acts would perform, but they weren't just musicians. There were tumblers, there were rumba dancers, there were acrobats, there were tap dancers, but there are also singers. And these three boys started off as harmony singers. And they were all schooled by this man, Joe Higgs, in Trenchtown. And each one was schooled to be the leader. There was no one leader. They took turns. And in a way, they became local heroes fairly early on. There was one period in the early 60s when they performed at this variety show. And Peter Tosh tells the story that the crowd was so enthralled by their performance that they showered the stage with coins. And it was only after the end of the performance that they realized, the crowd, that they were just as poor as the boys on stage, and they begged back the money. So they were steeped in that society. They were wedded to that very, very poor society, and they never really left it. That's the thing that I discovered in the course of the book. And that's why they were so powerful, because they were of that society, and they didn't, when they became famous or when they earned more money, didn't pull themselves away from the common people that they'd made their name with.
And indeed, there are people around the globe who know the name of Trenchtown and know something about this notorious Kingston slum, because Bob Marley, you know, even at the height of his popularity, would constantly refer to it. It would be there in song lyrics and things like that. One of the things that strikes me about even an early song like Trenchtown Rock is the, you know, there's the line, you reap what you sow. The religious imagery, biblical imagery and stuff, it sort of goes to the title of your book, Natural Mystics, doesn't it?
It does. They were all mystical men. They're all men, actually, who were very natural in that they were wedded to the land. I interviewed a woman called Esther Anderson for this book, and she was one of Bob Marley's many girlfriends. But for a number of years, she was his girlfriend. And she said that he carried the Bible around with him all the time, and so much so that she said, well, why don't you just sing the Bible? He was so wedded to the Bible. And as he grew as a Rastafarian, and as the others grew, they became proselytizers of this Rastafari cult or religion. I interviewed another man for the book, a man called Benjamin Foote, who was an early road manager for the Wailers here in the UK when they came to this country. They weren't known in the early 70s. And he talked about the fact that they would go up and down this small van on the motorway here in the UK to these very small gigs, universities or pubs or bars, and they would be arguing non-stop, Peter, Bunny and Bob. But they weren't arguing about the usual things. They weren't arguing about girls. They weren't arguing about the running order of songs. They were arguing over scripture. And you see that wedded in their music all the time. They are singing the Bible largely. They are very, very spiritual men. And I wanted to get that across, that actually, down the line, Rastas is what they were. They were fundamentally very religious fellows.
Mm-hmm. Did they grow up sort of in parallel with the rise of Rastafarianism in Jamaica?
I think they did. In a way, one of the points that I draw out in the book is to get the readers to think about Rastafarians. Rastafarians in the 1950s, when these boys were growing up, they were the outcasts. They were the dirty, barefoot, nasty people who were bagawire people, who wore rags, who were seemed to be feckless, were thought to be words shy. They were the sort of people that nobody wanted to have anything to do with. And yet in the course of 10 or 20 years, those same Rastafarians came to signify Jamaican culture. Mm-hmm. A culture coup happened. And it was their great fortune, in a way, to be in Jamaica and in Trenchtown at the time, because Trenchtown was full of intellectuals. It was a very poor ghetto, but it was full of street intellectuals. And one of the intellectuals who lived in Trenchtown was this Rastafarian elder called Mortimer Plano. He was an elder, but he was only in his 30s when he met them. And Mortimer Plano actually was a very shrewd man. And I liken the way that he worked with the Wailers to the way that someone like Elijah Muhammad worked with Muhammad Ali. Do you remember when Cassius Clay became Muhammad
right,
Ali,
yeah,
and announced that he was now a member of the Nation of Islam? Well, Elijah Muhammad used Muhammad Ali to proselytize on behalf of the Nation of Islam. And people like this man Mortimer Plano, this Rastafarian elder, used the Wailers to proselytize on behalf of Rastafari. So you can see the emergence of Rastafari with the emergence of reggae as a force throughout the world.
And do you hear it as early as that first single, Simmer Down, which came out in 1963?
Not quite, because Simmer Down was in their Rude Boy period. They even called themselves the Wailing Rude Boys at one stage. And Simmer Down was a kind of call to the Rude Boys. The Rude Boys were these feckless youths like themselves. Most young boys in Jamaica in their teens had no employment. Mm-hmm. But they had style and they had the suggestion of violence. And there was much violence even at that time. And that song, Simmer Down, is a call for the Rude Boys to calm down. It was only really a few years later, with the arrival of Haile Selassie, that they became real Rastafarians.
But they start as the Wailers with this single called Simmer Down, which went to number one in Jamaica by the year 1964. Simmer Down, the first single from the Wailers from 1963, number one in Jamaica by 1964. The Wailers, of course, were Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, and Bunny Livingston, the subjects of Colin Grant's book called The Natural Mystics, Marley, Tosh, and Wailer. He's with us in the studios of the BBC in London. Colin, you mentioned how it's really three books in one, the story of these three boys who would go on to bring this sound to a global audience, the story of Jamaica at a time of great social upheaval and transition, and the story of you as, you know, growing up in a Jamaican household in the UK, coming back and, you know, finding all of this information and all of this context for the music. But it occurs to me there's another story as well, which is the rise of Rasta culture. And you mentioned Haile Selassie before that clip, you know, this kind of,
yes, indeed,
you know, inadvertent and reluctant semi-deity over in Ethiopia who becomes this icon for all these young Jamaicans.
Yeah, he was rather perplexed by it himself. Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia, came to Jamaica in 1966 as a state visit. And I tell the story in the book that when he arrived on April 21st, 1966, there were tens of thousands of Rastafarians at the airport to greet him. And when the plane touched down and he looked out the window, he was petrified. He was bemused and petrified because they were chanting, they had their drums, their flags, they were smoking their pipes, and they were euphoric. But they were seeming to be so euphoric that they were scarily euphoric. And Haile Selassie wouldn't get off the plane. And the call came from the authorities on a megaphone for this man Mortimer Plano, this Rastafarian elder, to come up. And Rastafarian elder Mortimer Plano came up the stairs of the plane and turned towards the crowd. And rather like Moses parting the Red Sea, he got the crowd to part. And so Selassie was able to descend from the plane and begin his tour of Jamaica. But as I say, he was rather perplexed by it. I mean, they thought of him as Jesus Christ. And in a way, he had been not forewarned so much, but he'd been proclaimed, he'd been prophesied by people like Marcus Garvey. In a way, this black nationalist hero, Marcus Garvey, acted as a kind of John the Baptist mm-hmm. to Haile Selassie's Jesus Christ. So there was a great coming. You know, in the Bible it says, look to the east, princes shall come out of Africa. And so they came in the shape of this very diminutive Ethiopian emperor.
And so the mysticism of Rastafari culture as it played out in the three people we're talking about, Bob Marley, Peter Tosh, Bunny Wailer, it actually leads to three very different philosophies among the three of them, which I want to follow up on in just a moment, Colin. We're speaking with Colin Grant, author of the book The Natural Mystics, Marley, Tosh, and Wailer. And we'll pick up the thread of how each of the three of them responded to Rastafarianism and to global musical fame as we continue with Soundcheck.
From that morning free, as destruction of war, is there poverty? Is there poverty?
Our look at the three musicians behind the iconic reggae group The Wailers continues in a moment, and then later another iconic group of more recent vintage, Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, the Grammy-winning, allegedly jazz group. With more nominations in more categories than any other artist, they join us to play live in our studio later on Soundcheck. You're listening to a repeat broadcast of Soundcheck.
I shot the sheriff, but I didn't shoot no deputy. Oh, no, oh, I shot the sheriff.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with Colin Grant, author of the new book, The Natural Mystics, Marley, Tosh, and Wailer. It traces the story of the three musicians who founded this iconic reggae band, The Wailers. And we've heard about the musical and spiritual elements that brought them together. Colin, those same elements set the three of them out on three very different courses. You write, Bob Marley, accommodate and succeed. Peter Tosh, fight and die. Bunny Wailer, retreat and live. How do three childhood friends take three so disparate routes from the same place?
Well, they were very, very similar, but they were very, very different as well. When they met this man, Chris Blackwell, the head of Island Records in the early 70s, he saw them immediately as stars, but they'd spent 10 years more or less in the wilderness with some success, but largely not making much money. And when it came to it, he says, Chris Blackwell, that he couldn't work with Bunny and Peter. He could only really work with Bob. And it's a shorthand, is that Bob Marley was fair-skinned. He was an accommodator. He would accommodate the needs of the bosses in order to get on. And that's what he did. He wouldn't necessarily sell out, but he would be practical, more so than Peter and Bunny. Mm-hmm. Now, Peter Tosh was very tall, very black, always wore dark glasses and scared people and seemed to enjoy scaring people and seemed to be more militant. Famously, he said he didn't want equal rights. He didn't want peace. Peace was the diploma you got in the cemetery. And he led this very, very militant life, and he ended up being murdered. And then Bunny Wailer, a man who would rather plant his crops and feed his chickens rather than go on tour. So a man in retreat. So you have those three men there. You have the accommodator, you have the rebel, and you have the man in retreat. And you see those kinds of archetypes played out again and again in the Caribbean. But I think they became that way because they were three bullocks growing up in a paddock, more or less, until this man, Chris Blackwell, came and lifted the latch and one of them left. And I think there was the suggestion that Bob Marley, amongst the many black people in Jamaica, Bob Marley rose because of his fair colour, because mm-hmm. he was fair-skinned, because he had a so-called white father and black mother. And in a way, there is some truth to that, but obviously Bob Marley actually was the hardest worker of the three. But there was a way that he was able to disabuse people like Chris Blackwell, disabuse the mainstream, disabuse the white population of any kind of fear. In a way, Bob Marley was post-racial before Barack Obama.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, though, Colin, you told the story of the three of them touring in a little van, going to just pubs and colleges there in the UK and arguing not about the usual stuff but about scripture. You write that later on, as the Wailers are beginning to disintegrate, that those arguments become a lot more heated and are no longer, you know, three Rastas debating what this particular scriptural passage means.
Yeah, I think actually Bob Marley was asked about which race he belonged to. Famously, he said that because he had a white father, so-called white father, in Jamaican parlance, we say that he was not fully white. He was touched by the tar brush. The white father, but in essence he had a white father and black mother, and therefore he had to negotiate these very mean streets of Jamaica, especially in Kingston. At that time, in the ghetto of Trenchtown, it was a very, very black place, and a fair-skinned boy like Bob Marley would have been out of place. And I think he had to learn how to accommodate the prejudices of people around him. And I think he kept that, and he kept those skills when it came to actually interacting with white people. This is the time in Jamaica when white people, especially in the ghetto, were loathed because of the things that had gone on during slavery and during British rule, 300 years of colonial rule in Jamaica. And the resentment, I think, grew out of this idea that actually, when it came to it, people weren't equal and that you could be elevated by the colour of your skin. And famously, when Bob Marley sadly died in 1981, Bunny is still alive and Peter's still alive, and Island Records ring up Peter Tosh to tell him the bad news, and they're waiting for a response from Peter Tosh, and Peter says, well, if it's so, then it's so. Perhaps it leaves a little room for the rest of us to come through now, which is a very bitter thing to say. But I think what he's saying is that despite the generosity of Bob Marley, and he was a very generous man, in a way, Bob Marley cast everybody else in his shadow. It was said, amongst the mainstream anyway, that if it wasn't Bob Marley, it wasn't reggae. And I think the resentment of that eclipsed some of the friendship that had gone before. And I think it was a kind of hatred that only kith can feel for kin. Ultimately, I think they loved each other. They all loved each other. And Bunny especially never really fell out with Bob Marley. But there was this great estrangement between Marley and Tosh.
Well, let's give people a chance to hear some of Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer without Bob Marley. This is post-Wailers. Beginning with Peter Tosh and the song Equal Rights from 1977.
Crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice.
1977, Equal Rights from Peter Tosh, his second solo album. This song, Blackheart Man, is from Bunny Wailer's first solo album, released in 1976.
When I asked my mom if she could let me go out and play like little children do, she said, be careful of the stranger giving candies to children and then he take them away.
Of the three founding Wailers, Peter Tosh, Bob Marley, and Bunny Wailer, it is only Bunny who is alive today. Bob Marley died in 1981, was it, Colin?
That's right, 1981.
And Peter Tosh was murdered several years later. Hadn't there been an attempt on Bob Marley's life while he was still alive?
Yeah, there was an attempt in 1976 on Bob Marley's life, because Jamaica is a country divided into two political parties. There's the Jamaican Labour Party and the People's National Party. And in a way, you couldn't be on the fence. In the mid and late 70s, you had to take sides. And even if you didn't take sides, it was assumed that you were on one side or the other. And people assumed that Bob Marley was a political figure. And his opponents, the opponents of that party, took a shot at him. And it said in Jamaica about this nature of this patronage politics that when your party is in, you eat. And when the other man's party's in, you starve. Or when your party's in, you drive. And when the other man's party's in, you walk. And that kind of visceral hatred permeated Jamaican culture. And Bob Marley was caught up in that. And he escaped for about a year and a half in London, where he made that famous album Exodus, mm-hmm. out of the cauldron of that kind of visceral political violence.
So for someone who was so adept at accommodation, this was a situation in which accommodation was not really acceptable to either side, it seems.
No, it wasn't. But there was that famous moment in 1978, John, when Bob Marley agrees to come back to Jamaica for the One Love Peace concert. And I'm sure you're familiar with that moment when mm-hmm. he's on the stage and his dreadlocks are flying through the air like lightning rods. And he calls onto the stage with him the leader of the opposition, Edward Siaga, and Michael Manley, the prime minister. And these men hate each other, a very, very visceral hatred. They loathe each other, but they come on stage and he gets them to clasp hands. They're this holy trinity, these three men holding hands above his head. And Jamaicans would tell you that's rather like Jesus Christ on the cross, surrounded by the two thieves. But that was a call for unity, and it was a very powerful call for unity, which lasted for a little while. But before that moment of Bob Marley on the stage, Peter Tosh had preceded him. And Peter Tosh let loose a diatribe against the state and against the corrupt politicians and came to pay for it, because he was beaten up thereafter on many, many occasions. And as I said earlier, he didn't call for peace. He said peace was the diploma you got in the cemetery. He was still steeled in war. And actually, I don't think he ever left the ghetto. I don't think he ever left the violence of the ghetto. And in the end, sadly, in 1987, the ghetto claimed him. It's one of those ghetto men who claimed his life in 1987.
Mm. And as I say, there remains only Bunny Wailer. And the story of these three men is bookended by Colin Grant's search for the reclusive co-founder of the Wailers. And to find the full story, well, you'll just have to read the book. It's called The Natural Mystics, Marley, Tosh, and Wailer. Colin Grant is the author. He's also historian and contributor to the BBC Radio. He's been with us from the studios of the BBC in London. Colin, really a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much indeed, John.
The bars could not hold me.
Still to come, a visit from banjo master Bela Fleck and his band, the Flecktones. They'll play songs from their latest album, Rocket Science, in the Soundcheck studio. That's next.
You're listening to an encore edition of Soundcheck.